Hello, everybody, and welcome to Game Ball, the show where we talk about games and sports, and sometimes about sports and games. My name is Barry Flozo, and I am your host. Glad to be back here with you all after taking a little bit of a break. Today is Tuesday, September 12th. I was going to record an episode on the 11th yesterday, but decided against it to watch Monday Night Football. So we're going to go over all the topics I wanted to talk about yesterday, today, and then there'll be a bonus episode tomorrow. So we'll get some double doses of Game Ball, and we'll jump right on into it. And probably the biggest story over the weekend, obviously, is week one of the NFL season. It started last Thursday with the Chiefs and Patriots, and we went over a little bit in detail about the Chiefs and Patriots game back on Thursday and the unexpectedness of the Patriots losing and by quite as much as they did. And so watching week one over the weekend, it brought a little bit more of that silliness to it, where a lot of teams uncharacteristically played well or not as well, and whether or not it's going to be an omen for the future for them, or if it's something that it's just a little bit of a fluke and maybe they'll iron it out by week two or week three. Now, one game in particular that stands out to me was the Rams and the Colts game. And as I figured, the Colts were probably going to win this game. A lot of people picked A lot of people picked the Rams to win this game, and rightfully so. The Colts were without Andrew Luck. There's a lot of issues on the offensive line for the Colts, and just they don't seem to be like a team that's ready to compete quite yet. And I guess when Andrew Luck does come back, they'll probably be a little bit more competitive. And in the AFC South, it may be good enough for a playoff spot. We'll have to see really how the AFC South plays. The AFC South's a weird division. A lot of people have high expectations for some of the teams, especially the Jaguars, especially the Texans, and even the Titans, too, because the Titans are getting a lot better. But you really don't know how they're going to perform this season based off their Week 1 performances, and the Colts were no exception to that. Now, when I think myself and many other people thought the Rams were going to win this, I really thought it was going to be something along the lines of like a 20-17, maybe a 23-20 kind of win. So it's something really even keeled that shows that the Rams are ready to take the next step, but they only win by a little bit and the Colts kind of hang around. But it took me completely by surprise when the Rams ended up beating the Colts 46-9. And a lot of that is a testament to first how well Wade Phillips' defense is going and how well the players are responding to having Wade Phillips as a defensive coordinator, because as I mentioned on an earlier episode of Game Ball, I'm a big fan of Wade Phillips, and he's one of the best, if not the best, defensive coordinator in the game. Now, his head coaching leaves a little bit to be desired based off of his past track record, but he's inarguably one of the best defensive coordinators, and I always thought it was weird how the Broncos just let him walk in the offseason. It's understandable considering they changed head coaches and they want a fresh start, but Wade Phillips was something that I cannot believe that the Broncos passed up on re-signing him. And their loss is definitely the Rams' gain. The Rams scored a few defensive touchdowns. They completely overwhelmed the Colts. Now, I know it's probably not the biggest job in the world to prevent a Scott Tolzien-led offense to a victory. But, you know, the Rams really showed that they were able to hang defensively with the team. And we'll see what happens in future weeks. They have a big test next week against the Redskins with Kirk Cousins. But I think this is a sign for the future. And you know, even Jared Goff looked really well in his offense after a rough rookie season last year. And I think a lot of that has to do with how Sean McVay has taken the helm here as the head coach, being the youngest head coach in the league by far. I think he's only 31 years old. That's really young. And he had similar success when he was in Washington with Kirk Cousins. And I really think that Jared Goff is going to benefit a bit from how well Sean McVay can do an offense. And when you have that recipe along with Wade Phillips, you're going to run into success. Now, are the Rams going to win 40-9 every single week? Probably not. And honestly, they're probably going to lose more than they win this year. But I'm still one of those people that think they're going to have a better year than people think they're going to have. But it's a good first step for the Rams to get a win like this over the Colts, a team that historically over the past decade or so has been pretty solid and it's always competing for a playoff spot. And we'll see in the next couple of weeks whether or not this is more a testament to how much the Rams are improving or how bad the Colts actually are, or it could be a combination of both. You just really never know. And it speaks volumes about the job that Sean McVay has done so far and how Wade Phillips has done so far. And I think if I were Chuck Pagano, the head coach of the Colts, I would be a little worried. I don't know if he's going to be fired this season. It depends on how much they lose or if they keep losing. But it really all depends. But I don't see him being the Colts head coach next year unless they can have a monster turnaround and at least make the playoffs. But it's just one of those things that happens, and we'll see how it goes. But kudos to the Rams for one, not making a liar out of me, but for two, just doing a really good job of just establishing themselves out of the gate really, really well. So after that game, I think the next one that jumped out at me a little bit, and this may not jump out to a lot of people other than myself, but I want to take a little bit closer look at the Steelers and Browns game. I predicted on the show back last week that the Steelers would still beat the Browns, but it wasn't going to be a close game, or it was going to be a close game, excuse me. And I don't think I gave a numerical prediction, but the Steelers ended up being the Browns 21-18. Now you're looking at it, it's like, okay, it's a divisional game. You know, the Steelers are going to beat the Browns by a couple points. It's no big deal, but it's a kind of a big deal when you really think about it. The Steelers are a very sexy pick to make the Super Bowl this year and win the AFC. And the Browns are in the rebuilding process. They have a rookie quarterback. They have just a young team all around them, and they're probably still a year or two away from trying to get into the conversation of competing. And it could be just week one blues, and I would suspect a lot of these are week one blues. But the Browns really played the Steelers tough, and the Steelers had to pull one out in the end to even beat the Browns. And a lot of people were kind of writing this game off as of, okay, yeah, the Steelers are, you know, they're dominant over the Browns. They're going to have an easy time against them. I thought the same thing, even though I said the score may be closer than what people would think it was. That was only because to account for the week one blues. And again, it remains to be seen whether or not this is just a fluke, or if the Browns are really improving, or on the flip side, if the Steelers are actually reeling. And I have a hard time believing that because of the weapons they have on offense and how I guess their defense has improved a little bit, especially with the addition of Joe Hayden. He's going to be a nice addition to the Steelers' secondary. And I still think the Steelers are going to be one of the dominant teams in the AFC, but watch out for the Browns now, because if they play the Steelers like this, if they play really any team like they played the Steelers this week, they're going to be in for a nice year. Not going to be, I don't think they're going to even sniff the playoffs, but it's going to be a nice year this year nonetheless. And the last game I really want to highlight from week one that jumped out to me, other than, I guess, maybe the Ravens shutting out the Bengals, which, I mean, I guess you can talk about that a little bit, but I was really surprised about the result of the Cowboys and Giants game. Now, I expected this to be a closer game than it was, and if you take into account that the Cowboys were in the red zone a few times and they just, for whatever reason, couldn't score a touchdown, they would not have won this game 19-3. They probably would have won this game like 35-3 or even 28-3. This game statistically was not close, and it really surprised me for a number of reasons. One, the Giants' defense is really good, and obviously it showed here by just allowing the Cowboys to score 19 points. But, I mean, Ezekiel Elliott for the Cowboys was having a great day on the ground. Dak Prescott looked a little bit rusty, but he was able to get it together later in the game. And they were pretty much, at least in the first half, able to do what they wanted to do on offense, even though it didn't translate into points. But even what's more surprising is how the Giants' offense operated. Now, it's, you know, it's understandable that they're going to struggle a little bit more when they don't have Odell Beckham Jr. in the lineup, and he adds a whole other dimension to that offense. But even if they had him in that game, I'm not so sure the result would have been much different. I'm sure the Giants maybe would have scored a couple more points, and the score would have looked a little closer. But the Giants' offense just absolutely sputtered on Sunday night. They didn't really move the ball that well. They didn't even get the ball into Cowboys territory until the third quarter. So they didn't even get past the 50-yard line until half the game was over. And it's just, I have a hard time understanding why, with some of the weapons they have Brandon Marshall. They have, you know, whoever. Eli Manning is a good quarterback. I'm not going to say he's a bad quarterback, but the offense should not have had as much trouble as they did. And I'm as much as I want to give the Cowboys defense some credit, I think it was more so the inability of the Giants to move the ball than it was the Cowboys defense, because the Cowboys defense looked good last night, or on Sunday night, I should say, and I think they're going to be a little bit better than people give them credit for this season. But I don't think they're going to be a dominant force. They're going to be exposed by a lot of good teams with better offenses than the Giants do. But the Giants so far, they've come off really flat, and they come just looking like they didn't know what was going on. They weren't ready for the Cowboys to come out and do this to them. And by comparison, last year on offense, the Cowboys fielded essentially the same team against the Giants on week one, and they gave up. The Cowboys scored 19 points, and I think the Giants scored 20. So the Giants definitely have taken a step back since last year. They have a lot of things to work out. I suspect when Odell Beckham comes back, they're going to be a little bit better on offense, but I'm not quite sure how much better they're going to be. So it's going to be an interesting thing to see how that unfolds in the NFC East, whether or not the Giants are actually as good as people thought they were going to be, or if it's just a fluke like other teams seem to have in week one. So overall, week one of the NFL season was really good. It was good to see football back again. That wasn't a preseason game. It has me excited for the rest of the season and all the other games that are coming up. And on Thursday night, we're going to be able to see the Texans and the Bengals Thursday night football. So that one's coming up in a couple days, and then we have some good matchups later and on Sunday and Monday. And I'll go over those, my predictions, on Friday's episode of Game Ball. And overall, my picks are this week for week one. I was 11-4 overall in the 15 games that were played. That's not a bad start. A lot of people were a little bit less. Some of the teams that they were expecting to win did not, and I picked against them. And I feel pretty good about my picks this week. One more thing about week one that I want to touch on, and it's not related to football. Well, it's related to football, but it's not related to the games at all. And that's the highly anticipated debut of the new color commentator for the CBS number one team, and that's a former Cowboys quarterback, Tony Romo. Now, I've always admired Tony Romo. I think he's a lot better of a quarterback than people give him credit for sometimes. I think he just was plagued by bad luck throughout his career, and that's why he and the Cowboys never really got close to a Super Bowl in his time in Dallas. But his debut in the broadcast booth, before it happened, it concerned me a little bit, because I didn't really know how much Romo would make the transition to being a broadcaster, especially in the very unorthodox move that it happened with, when he just basically got hired on, no strings attached, number one commentator, and they sent Phil Simms down to do the analyst in the pre- and post-game shows for CBS. And so I was kind of a little skeptical about how Romo would be at first. And to be sure, he came out and the reviews on him were good, mostly. He did have some times here or there where he either stuttered or the flow wasn't very good, or he just kind of seemed like he was out of place. But for the most part of it, he seemed to fit pretty well in with Jim Nantz in the broadcast booth. And I think that's only going to get better as not only this season, but future seasons go on for Romo. And the one thing that really has dazzled people about Tony Romo in the booth is his ability to predict plays. Now, there's a bunch of clips online of this at different times throughout the game, but throughout various parts of the Titans and Raiders game that he called on Sunday, he was circling different things, and he was telling Jim Nantz, and I guess the audience as well, what a particular player was going to do, or what an audible was going to do, and how the defense was going to react to something. And for the most part, he was right on about what was going to happen, and it was really cool to see him predict this and to kind of show the audience his football prowess and what he's accomplished over the past 14 years as an NFL quarterback. And I think that Romo had a solid debut, and I hope he gets better in the coming weeks, because, you know, that's what he's doing now. And a lot of people speculate whether or not Tony Romo is going to stay in the booth, or if he's going to come down and, you know, join a team that really needs a quarterback. And when he first announced his, I guess, you know, quote unquote retirement from the NFL, I kind of suspected that he was going to do this on a temporary basis, and then he was going to jump back up into a team that needed him. But that diminished a little bit in the offseason when the Dolphins ran into trouble. I mean, I know the Dolphins with their quarterback Ryan Tannehill, that happened kind of late in training camp, and then they brought on Jay Cutler. But I kind of was suspicious that maybe Romo want to go down to Miami and join the Dolphins, or in Chicago if you want to go join the Bears, or in New York for the Jets. But his ability to move away from the temptations of joining a team that needs a quarterback has me convinced, at least for now, that he's going to stay in the booth, and he wants to do this, and he wants to commit to it. And I think that's good on him, because he doesn't need to have his mind in many different places. And if that's what he's going to focus on, just being in the booth broadcasting, I think that's probably best for Tony Romo. And again, I think he's gonna do pretty well at it. And I know a lot of people like to get on Phil Simms for his quality of commentary, and a lot of the criticism is justified. Phil Simms sometimes is not the best color commentator, but he did it for a long time, and I wish that CBS would have handled that issue a little bit better than they did, but all we can do is sit and watch. We can't really have much of an effect over the commentators for a football game. But all the best for Tony Romo. We'll keep an eye on him and how he does in his future games, and he should do well. So after that, let's move on a little bit to something different, back into the video game world. There was an announcement that was posted on IGN yesterday about this developer that's working on the Nintendo Switch. There's a game coming out for the Switch. It's an indie game called Lickspear. I'm not good with pronouncing things that don't look very... I have trouble pronouncing words sometimes. Let's leave it at that. But essentially, a developer for that game was doing an Ask Me Anything, an AMA on Reddit, and he revealed to the people that were talking about, that were asking him questions, that on the game, they are releasing an achievement system that's, you know, akin to what is on the Xbox One and the PlayStation 4, which essentially means that Nintendo is working on rolling out an achievement system on the Switch in the near future. And that's really big, because Nintendo, as you know, up to my knowledge, has not really had an achievement system on any of their consoles, at least on their home consoles. And really, I can't think of any console where they have a dedicated achievement system on it. That's basically, if you accomplish something in a game, you get a little achievement, kind of like what you do in the games for the Xbox One or the PS4, and even other platforms as well. And I guess he kind of jumped the gun on announcing it, but I think he tried to cover up his tracks by saying that Nintendo's been hinting at it for a while. He was just kind of, I guess, confirming it. And I wonder how big of a deal it is to have an achievement system for Nintendo consoles. A lot of people, it's intriguing to me, because one of the criticisms about the Switch, or just Nintendo products in general, is that Nintendo does not have an achievement system on their consoles. And that's always been a little bit of a confusing criticism for me, because at least when I play video games, I don't really care all that much about achievements. I mean, they're pretty cool when you accomplish something really at a key point of a game, or if you get some rare little thing that not a lot of people get and it kind of slips by people, you say, oh, look what I did. I got an achievement. I can share it off. But it's not one of those things where I look to maximize my achievements and where I want to just collect every single one of them. Maybe I'm different. Maybe a lot of people do like doing that and I'm just weird. But it never made sense to me to criticize Nintendo for not implementing this, because they wanted to focus more on just having their games out there, just doing things for their games, and not so much about, hey, look, it's an achievement system. But since it appears that an achievement system is finally coming to the Switch, people can be appeased by that. And I guess it's a big deal, because it was a big front feature article on IGN yesterday. And we'll see what games implemented it. I don't really see any of the Mario games getting it right away. I'm sure they will in the future, but we'll see about that. And that really brings into question, when will the achievement system be rolled out? I don't know when Lickspear is supposed to be released for the Switch. I can look it up real quick, but it seems to me that a good timing for the rollout achievement the rollout of achievements for the Switch is going to be when they release the Nintendo Switch Online service, and that was supposed to be released sometime this fall, so sometime in the next few months the Nintendo was supposed to release the online service, but they've pushed it back until next year a little bit. And there could be many reasons for that. It could be a lot more complicated than they thought. They're trying to implement a lot of cool features, maybe have the virtual console come out at that same time. But having Nintendo Switch Online out sometime next year gives them a perfect opportunity to say, hey, here's another big update. We're going to include achievements on here, so you can share them online. You can do whatever it is you want to do with the achievements. And that's my best guess for when it'll actually come out. Again, not sure when it's going to come out, but that would be my best guess. I wasn't able to really find out when Lickspear is supposed to come out for the Switch. It's probably on the internet somewhere. I just didn't really want to go much into it, but it's cool. I'm glad that Nintendo is doing it. It was never a deal breaker for me. I never was not going to buy the Switch because they didn't have achievements, and I was never going to go and throw a riot because The Switch didn't have achievements on it, but it's something that I'm glad that Nintendo is implementing, if not only than to appease the fan base that seems to have a lot of really unrealistic expectations of Nintendo. You know, I love my Nintendo games, and people that enjoy them as well, I find it great that there's still a lot of people out there that really get in good enjoyment from Nintendo games. But I always get by how some of the fans react to different things. It's as if that this gaming company, that they create entertainment products for you to enjoy, that they have to listen to all of the very sometimes unrealistic demands that you're putting out there. And you know, some of it's warranted. Nintendo can do a lot of things better. There's a lot of in the Nintendo experience they can do better, but there's a lot where they either don't have to do better or they shouldn't do better at, just because it's their company. They can operate it how they want to. And I don't know where the criticism comes from in terms of geographical locations, but if we're talking strictly about people in the United States, for example, going after Nintendo for these things, it's really a cultural difference. Nintendo is first and foremost a Japanese-based company. Yes, they do have a headquarters in Washington in the United States, not Washington, D.C., Washington State. And they also have a headquarters somewhere in Europe. And, you know, fittingly, their names are Nintendo of America and Nintendo of Europe in those instances. And essentially, Nintendo of America and Nintendo of Europe, they operate separately. Well, not really, but they're kind of their own thing. But they all kind of filter and funnel back into the main Nintendo headquarters in Japan. But a lot of people think that Nintendo of America, because they're Nintendo's representation in the United States, I guess in Canada and Mexico as well, they can just kind of go in there and make a lot of some demands and expect it to be done. But everything always ends up back at the main company, because Nintendo of America doesn't do much differently than what the Japanese version of Nintendo does, save for maybe deciding on which games get released or how games are localized, things of that nature. So it's a good sign that Nintendo is listening to some concerns, but it's never going to appease people, to be perfectly honest with you. People are always going to find something to get upset about. And if you're wondering what exactly do I mean by that, let's take The Legend of Zelda Breath of the Wild, for example. Fantastic game on the Switch. It was released on the Wii U as well. It was actually the very last game released on the Wii U, and I have not played the Wii U version. I never picked it up for that console, but I do have it for the Switch, and it's a great game. It's fantastic. It's about as fun as you'd expect it to be. I'm not critical of it, but I think a lot of reviewers who were giving it a perfect score were a little too generous. I probably would have given it like an 8 or a 9 out of 10, not a perfect 10, but that's my opinion. But a lot of people were griping, for one, about the graphics of Zelda, of the game, about different things. It's just little menial things that people pick on just because they can't find anything else to pick on. And nothing can ever be perfect, nothing can ever satisfy their needs, and that's just how it goes usually sometimes. And even though Nintendo is addressing various fan concerns, I guess like the achievement system, if you can call that a concern, but I think they should. Now this is an unpopular opinion amongst a lot of people, but I think they should continue doing business how they want to do it, as long as it makes sense for the financial security of their company. Do you want to make your customers happy? Absolutely, you do. You don't want to completely neglect your customers and just throw them under the bus and say, well, all we do is care about a profit. But Nintendo, people forget, has been around since the late 1800s. They've been around for a really, really long time. They've been through a lot of ups and downs that I'm sure some companies just never survived. And remember, even though they're a Japanese-based company and they didn't come over to the United States for several decades after the fact, but during the Great Depression, they survived that. And of course, it probably did not hit Japan as hard as it did in the United States. But when you think of the United States as a world market, anything like that, the Great Depression, the Great Recession of last decade, those have effects on world markets, and Nintendo has survived through it all. And they've done it doing things how they want to do it. And for better or for worse, that's how Nintendo has always operated, and that's how they're going to operate in the future. And I think they should continue operating like that unless it no longer makes sense for them to do it. Now, a couple of years ago, when their stock prices tanked and they were not doing as well as people thought they were, I don't think that was because they weren't what you would call listening to their customers about improvements they were making. I think most of it had to do with the poor execution of their Wii U console, how they marketed it, how they named it, how they were doing things. I don't really think it was because they didn't listen to customers, because Nintendo has always done it their way. And you just look at the consoles they release. Let's start with the Wii in 2006, 2007. You have the PlayStation following their model, and that's with the Xbox. You have the PS3 and you have the Xbox 360. They're both pretty similar consoles. It's just a matter of different games and different other little things. But then you look at the Nintendo Wii, which was drastically different from anything you've ever seen. It had motion controls. It was a weird little box, and it was just really weird. And that's just Nintendo. Nintendo does weird things, and that's what they're known for. And so I think it's good that they're not doing what a lot of companies do and cave into kind of silly demands from a fringe group of their customer base, because I have no doubt that, save for the vocal people on the internet and elsewhere, that most fans of Nintendo products are pretty happy with what they do. I have my frustrations, like some people do, but for the most part, I enjoy when Nintendo releases a new game or a new console, a new whatever, and I enjoy it, and it's how I roll, and it's how a lot of people probably should roll. So let's dip back into sports a little bit. This one is regarding baseball again, and this is a story from Sunday. I was going to get to it yesterday, but again, I was not able to, but it's from Sunday, and it's about the Washington Nationals. Now, they are the first team in baseball this season to clinch their division. They clinched the National League East Division on September 10th, which is really, really early. It's remarkable how early the Nationals were able to clinch their division. And a lot of people will say that they were able to do it only because of how weak their division is. And you know what? You're probably 100% right. They were able to win their division because it's an easy division. The Marlins, the Braves, the Mets, and the Phillies, not that good this year. And clinching it on September 10th is early, but that's just how it goes when you play in a weak division. And the only other team that is... There's two teams in the American League that are on the verge of clinching probably in the next few days. The Indians, their magic number for the division is 6, and the Astros are 7. So probably within the next week or so, they'll clinch it. Even the Dodgers, who have been on just that unbelievable, terrible streak over the past several weeks, their magic number is 10. But it's remarkable that the Nationals are able to do it this early. And you don't want to take anything away, even though they were in a tough division. Now, I say that because take a look at the Nationals this season. If you're not someone who follows the Washington Nationals, it's fine. But one thing that's missing from some of the criticism about how the National League East Division was this year is how much the Nationals have responded to injury. Now, every team in every sport, every single season, goes through injuries that affect their team, and the best teams are able to come out of it unscathed or mitigating the damage as much as they can. And if you look at the Nationals, I don't know the exact their ranking within baseball teams, Major League Baseball teams, of how many people they had on the disabled list, but let me give you a list right now of all of the Nationals that have been on the disabled list at some point or another this season. You have Trey Turner, their shortstop. You have Jason Worth, their left fielder. You have Adam Eaton, their center fielder. Bryce Harper, their star right fielder. Max Scherzer, their ace pitcher. Steven Strasburg, their other ace hitcher, their pitcher. Joe Ross, a pitcher. Brian Goodwin, a center fielder. Eni Romero, a reliever. Ryan Madsen, a reliever. Matt Albers, a reliever. Coda Glover, a closer. Michael Taylor, a center fielder. Sean Kelly, a reliever. Joe Blanton, a reliever. Ryan Rayburn, a utility guy who could play left field. And Stephen Drew, who's a utility guy that could be second base or shortstop. And there could be even more. That's just the list that I can remember off the top of my head. And of those people, of all those people who have spent time on the disabled list, a good portion of them are really important to the Nationals' offense or their pitching staff. I mean, Trey Turner and Jason Worth, Bryce Harper, Max Scherzer, Steven Strasburg, those are some really, really important keys to the Nationals. And even with them missing time, some of them simultaneously, Trey Turner and Jason Worth missed time together. Bryce Harper missed time together with Trey Turner and Worth and Scherzer. Some players are even out for the season that they expected to contribute greatly, especially Adam Eaton, who tore his ACL back at the end of April, and he's out for the entire year, and he's the guy that the Nationals traded three of their best pitching prospects for to the White Sox in the offseason. So my point is here, even though the Nationals had a pretty easy division with a bunch of not very good teams, they had to climb over some hills themselves. And remember, they don't just play teams in their division. They play teams in other divisions as well, and they've had a pretty good record over them. Don't have the numbers in front of me exactly right now, but they've played the National League West this year. In fact, when they were in Los Angeles back right before the Dodgers went on their historic run of wins, they took 2 out of 3 against the Dodgers in LA. That's pretty impressive. They beat teams in other divisions that they probably wouldn't have had otherwise. They took 2 out of 3, I believe, against the Astros when they were down in Houston last month. And, I mean, this Nationals team is not perfect. They still have some holes. I know their bullpen has improved quite a bit over the past couple months, but I still think their bullpen is a little shaky. Their offense is probably going to struggle to score a ton of runs when they get to the playoffs, if not only because Bryce Harper is still out of the lineup. But this is a really good team, and they have, over the past, I think it's 3 or 4 seasons, maybe even 5, they have the best record of every single baseball team in the major leagues except for the Dodgers, and the Dodgers, I believe, have only one more win than they do. So that's impressive. The Nationals have put together a good team, and this early clinch can be both a good and bad thing. It allows them to rest easy knowing that they're going to have a playoff series in a few weeks, but it's also, they have to remember to keep their momentum going at the end of the season. And it's important also because since the Dodgers are on their slow streak, and I think slow streak is being a little too nice to them, the Nationals, they can still catch the Dodgers for the best record in the National League, and even maybe the best record in all of baseball, which could give them home field advantage should they make it to the World Series. Now, the Indians are hot on the heels for best record in all of baseball, but let's ignore that for a second. Let's look at the best record in the National League. The Dodgers have been sitting at 92 wins for 11 games now. They have lost 11 games in a row, which is their worst streak since they moved to Los Angeles. And so they're 92-52, which is still, by all accounts, a fantastic record, still the best in baseball. But the Nationals are nipping at their heels. They're 88-55. So they're only about 4 games back of the Dodgers in the best record for the National League standings. And depending on how the Dodgers do and depending on how well the Nationals play down the stretch, they could overtake them for the best record in the National League. Do I think they're going to? I don't think so. I think that the Nats, they're not going to, I don't want to say struggle down the stretch, but I don't think they're going to win a ton of games down the stretch because I think they're going to be playing their backups a lot more than they would have if they were still in the race for the division. But they're still going to win games because they're just a good team and they play a lot of divisional opponents the rest of the way. But they only need 12 wins of their last 19 to get to 100 wins. I don't see them getting there. I think that they're probably going to finish just a little bit below that mark. I think they'll probably get like 97 or 98, maybe 99 wins. We'll see. But yeah, I don't think the Nationals are going to run the Dodgers down because I do believe that the Dodgers are going to turn around here soon. Don't know how much of a streak they're going to go on to close the season, but I think they're going to pull themselves out of this funk sooner rather than later. And I think the Nationals are going to just kind of coast a little bit down the stretch. So I don't think they're going to chase them down. But it's interesting to see how things have changed over the past few weeks. I remember the Dodgers had a big lead by like maybe 16 or 17 games over the Nationals for the best record in the National League, and now it is only 4, and that's pretty impressive if you think about it. And so, should they do this? Should the Nationals chase the Dodgers for the best record? Now, from a standpoint of probably a player and coaches, you would say, yeah, let's go for it, because, you know, we'll get home field advantage in the playoffs, we won't really care who we play. It's a good time for all. You want to win all the games you can because you play to win the game, basically. But if you're looking at it from a fan's perspective, you kind of see who you would face if you were to take the best record over, and you kind of want to wonder whether or not they should or not, because as it stands right now, assuming that the Nationals don't lose every single game left and the Cubs win every single game, and again, assuming that the Cardinals or the Brewers don't run down the Cubs, the Nationals are going to play the National League Division Series against the champion of the NL Central. So they're either going to play the Cubs, the Cardinals, or the Brewers in the NLDS, whoever wins that division. And a lot of people would argue that that's a lot better than playing the winner of the wild card, which at this point is probably either going to be Arizona or Colorado. And if you were looking at a head-to-head matchup, probably Arizona. Now, I would argue that Arizona is objectively better than the Cubs, Cardinals, and Brewers. So if you're the Nationals and you go and you win the best record and you play the winner of the wild card game, would you rather have it over the NL Central team? Now, I'm not taking anything away from whoever is the champion of the National League Central. They're all really good teams. And the Nationals, actually, they've struggled a little bit against the Brewers this year, but I think they've beaten the Cubs and the Cardinals a majority of the time they played them. So I'm not going to say that playing the NL Central champs is going to be a cakewalk for the Nats. All I'm saying is, would they rather have better odds of advancing to the NLCS by playing a team that they know they can beat as opposed to a team like the Diamondbacks where they just don't know, or the Rockies where anything goes in a series that's in Colorado? So I don't know what they should do. If I were a fan of the Nationals, I'd probably just say keep on playing to win, and whatever happens, happens. And it's your time to shine, because even if they do avoid the Diamondbacks or Rockies in the first round, let's just say for the sake of argument they go to the NLCS, they're going to play a good team regardless if they do that. They're going to play either the Dodgers, the Diamondbacks, or the Rockies. All three of them are really good teams. And then let's say for the sake of argument they go to the World Series. They're going to play either the Astros, the Indians, or the Red Sox, or maybe even the Yankees, all really good teams. So it's not like that the Nationals are going to avoid playing a good team if they are able to clinch the best record in the National League. So it's one of those things where I think they should just go and they should just keep on trying to win. And that's really my personal opinion on that. But the Nationals, they've had a good season. They're doing really well, and best of luck to them in the playoffs. They haven't won a playoff series since they moved to Washington, and they replaced the Montreal Expos, who a lot of you probably do remember the Expos, but they moved from Montreal, Canada to Washington, D.C. back in 2005. And before they were the Nationals, when they were the Expos, they only made the playoffs one time in their entire history, and that was back in 1981. But as the Nationals franchise, they have now made it four times, one in 2012, 2014, 2016, and now 2017. And in each of the previous three playoff appearances, they were unable to advance past the NLDS. So a lot of Nats fans are really hoping that this could be the year they break through and get to at least the NLCS or maybe even the World Series. I mean, for them, it'd be a nice precursor to hosting the All-Star game next year. But we still have a few weeks left of the season to play until the playoffs start. So we'll see what the Nationals end up doing, and we'll see if the Dodgers can get out of their funk. All right, so I would like to spend the last about 10 minutes or so of the program, maybe even a little bit less, we'll see how it goes, talking about the Nintendo Direct that's coming tomorrow, September 13th. And Nintendo announced this, I believe, yesterday. And it's one of their, I guess it's a quarterly thing that Nintendo does, but I don't know the exact times on it. I think it's like a 3 p.m. Pacific, 6 o'clock Eastern, whatever time works it out. You can find it online pretty easily. But they're doing a Direct tomorrow, and people don't really know exactly what they're going to be talking about. They just know they're going to be talking about games for the Switch and the 3DS, which, surprise, surprise, is their two consoles they have out. But given the timing of the Direct, it seems like they're going to be probably focusing a lot on Super Mario Odyssey and maybe Pokemon Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon. Mario Odyssey, as you know, comes out at the end of October, on October 27th, and Pokemon Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon, I believe, comes out in the middle of November. November 17th it comes out, so it comes out a little bit later than the middle, but about mid to late November those games come out. So they're probably going to talk a little bit more about those two games, and they're probably going to also throw in some of their Mario and Luigi Superstar Saga Bowser's Minions game. Now, that's one that's actually kind of flown under the radar a little bit. If you're unaware, Mario and Luigi Superstar Saga plus Bowser's Minions is essentially a remake of the original Game Boy Advance game Mario and Luigi Superstar Saga, and they're adding a little bit of a bonus on there with Bowser's Minions. I'm still not privy on what exactly that is, but it's a little, I guess, a little side thing you can do with Bowser's little goons he has going out there, but that's going to be a 3DS release, and I guess that's the latest entry in the Mario and Luigi RPG series. It should be cool. The original game, Superstar Saga, was really fun. I enjoyed playing it for the Advance. It was a very deep and very long game that just was very well done. And the Mario and Luigi games that have come out since, they've been good. They've kind of tailed off in quality in recent years, but they're good for the most part. So it'll be nice to see a good remake done for them. And I think they'll probably also touch a little bit about their Xenoblade Chronicles 2 that's coming out early next year, or is it coming out late this year? I think it's coming out early next year or sometime within the first quarter of next year. Coming out this year. They don't have a specific date. So if I had to guess, since Nintendo has not given an official date for Xenoblade 2, probably going to announce the date of that at the Direct tomorrow as well. Maybe scheduled for a holiday release, maybe sometime in November or December, or maybe they'll do what they did with Zelda Breath of the Wild and say it's going to be released maybe next month or in early November. We'll see how it goes. I'm pretty sure that's what they're going to be focused on, though. But Nintendo is notorious in their directs for offering some surprise announcements. The last direct with the Pokemon games, they kind of teased for the entire time that they were going to talk about something, and at the very, very end, they talked about how they were going to release a mainline Pokemon series for the Nintendo Switch, and then back in January, when they were doing their direct about the reveal of the Switch, they at the very, very, very end, they gave a trailer for Zelda Breath of the Wild after not talking about it for the entire game or the entire presentation, and then revealing it was a launch title. So Nintendo is notorious for hiding little bits of secrets and some much-anticipated things at the very end of their directs. So a little bit about maybe what they'll do tomorrow, assuming they do it again tomorrow. You could see something about Nintendo Switch Online. Maybe they'll finally release when it's going to be coming on sometime next year. But heck, maybe they'll surprise us, and say that it's going to come out later this year. Maybe they'll talk about the achievements that was being talked about a few minutes ago by myself about the developer who revealed that Nintendo's probably going to have an achievement system. They'll talk about more Pokemon Ultra Sun and Ultra Moon probably, but they might add some more stuff to that. And another possibility is maybe they'll talk about a previously unannounced game. Maybe they'll completely surprise us and say they're working on a game that's not related to anything that's been kind of in the discussions over the past several months. I don't know exactly what that will be, because it seems like this year Nintendo has kind of hit all cylinders of their various franchises they have. If anything, it could be maybe another Mario Party game. They could be announcing more details about Mario and Sonic at the Olympic Games, because that's going to be coming out pretty soon if it's not out already, since the Olympics start in just a couple months. It really could be anything if they do announce a game. I'm not 100% sure that they're going to be announcing anything for a new game. It could be, though, but it would make too much sense for them to add that kind of a surprise to the end of their directs like they usually do on their directs. But regardless, it'll be fun. It'll be cool to see a few more details about these games, and maybe they'll omit some of these things that I expect to be in there. You never know with Nintendo. They're always like that. So it'll be fun to see. So that's about all the time I have today on Game Ball. I will be back tomorrow on Wednesday, September 13th, talking more on the show. By the time I put this online tomorrow, it'll probably be past Nintendo Direct, so maybe I'll talk a little bit about the Nintendo Direct and what happened during it during the next show, and cover a few other things in sports, preview of the Thursday night Texans and Bengals game, so that should be fun as well, and a few other things as well. So again, thank you everybody for listening. My name is Barry Flozo. This has been Game Ball. I will see you next time.